I want to start with a question today, and I want you to do some thinking about it, because sometimes I think we hear a question and we just have an impulse, but I really want you to think about it, and here's the question. If you could see your future, would you want to see it? Now just think about it for a moment. If you could see what lies ahead, what's around the corner, if you could see your future, would you want to see it? If someone could predict your future and tell you where you would ultimately end up in life, and also tell you how you got to where you're gonna ultimately end up in life, would you want them to tell you? If someone could predict your future health, what your health looks like, what it doesn't look like, if somebody could tell you about your future level of happiness towards the latter part of your life, or what your financial condition will be at that stage of your life, would you wanna know? If someone could tell you that, would you wanna know? If they could tell you about the condition of what your faith is ultimately gonna be like towards the latter part of your life, and how that would be, would you wanna know? Would you wanna know about the overall quality of your life? You know, are you happy? Are you not so happy? Or you're just discouraged and depressed and miserable? If somebody could tell you what that was gonna look like, would you want to know? And as you're thinking about this, let me just add a little bit more to it and say, well, what if what you could see about your future, what if you could see your future in such a way that also allowed for you to change unwanted outcomes starting today? That you could see the future, but what you saw in the future, if you needed to, if you wanted to, you could make changes and tweaks and adjustments today in order to avoid where you're gonna end up, or if where you end up is where you've always wanted to end up, you could maintain your current status. You could maintain your current course because you know where you're gonna end up, it's gonna be profitable. Now, most of us, I think if we're honest, about whether or not we would want to be able to know our future, see our future, I think, if we're being honest, I think most reasonable people would say, yeah, I want to know what my future is, especially if I can make changes, if I can make adjustments, because why would we not want to know what the future is if we also have the capacity to make needed adjustments today to change the outcome of things if the outcome needs changed? So if we could see our future and we had the opportunity to either make necessary changes or to maintain the current set of decisions that we're currently making to ensure that we end up where we've always wanted to end up, what if I told you that there was a way for you and I to know our future? What if I told you there was a way to predict your future? What if I told you there was a way to know where you end up and where I end up in life and how we would ultimately end up getting there? What if you could know about your future health, what that looks like, your future happiness, your future finances, your future faith, and your overarching quality of life? There is a way to see your future, and I'm gonna tell you what that is. And some of you, it may not surprise you. Others, it may surprise you a great deal, but you can know your future and you can see your future, and I can know and see my future. And if you wanna know the future for you, and if you wanna know what the future holds for you, then all you have to do is just look at your friends. It's the old saying, you show me your friends, I will show you your future. Your friends are a window to your future. Your friends will show you what your future is going to ultimately look like, because the quality of our future depends on the quality of our friends. And this is something that both science and the scriptures are in lockstep agreement about. I wanna take just a moment, I wanna give you some of the latest research. Before we open up the scriptures, I wanna tell you a little bit about what science is saying about friendship and the power of friendship and the importance of friendship. According to some of the latest research, 70% of a husband and wife's satisfaction within a marriage, 70% of their satisfaction within a marriage is connected to their friendships outside the marriage. And at first glance, it's really even kind of difficult to understand how that is, but once you begin to think about it, you understand that if you're married, the friendships that you have outside that marriage, those are very important. And so researchers have determined that 70% of a husband and wife's satisfaction in a marriage is connected to the friendships that they have outside the marriage. Research says that if you consider your boss or your manager a personal friend, you're 2.5 times more likely to love your job. Or if you have three people that you work with that you consider to be good friends, you are 80% more likely to say that you are happy with your life. A 2006 study took breast cancer patients who had 10 close friends and breast cancer patients who had zero friends. And if you were part of the first group that had 10 close friends, your chance of recovery was quadrupled when compared to a group without friends, because that's the power of friendship. And surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, they discovered in that study, husbands had zero impact in the outcome. Now, the same thing was true for men. A long-term study of over 700 men showed that close friendships drastically, significantly reduced the likelihood of heart problems and heart disease. And once again, more so than the wife, because the power of friendship in some way surpasses the influence of our husband or our wife. There was a landmark study done by Brigham Young University, which determined, after they did a meta-analysis, which means that they just took all of these other studies that had been done over a period of years, and they tried to dig in and figure out what are all of these studies discovering. And they came to the conclusion that friendship is a more powerful predictor of physical health than diet and exercise. That friendship is a more powerful predictor of how a person will be as far as their physical health goes, more so than diet and exercise. It's more consequential. It's also been shown over and over again that friendship, close friendship, meaningful friendship, has the ability to improve our mental health by lowering our levels of depression and anxiety. Study after study shows that the power of friendship and the influence of friendship is far more than that of family. That your friends have more impact on you than even your family, or the absence of friendship has even more impact on you than your close biological family. A Michigan State study discovered that friends are the biggest predictor of both physical health and emotional happiness in life. And again, it's just the power of friendship. If you have a friend who's unhealthy and obese, you're 57% more likely to be unhealthy and obese. But the flip side, the positive side, is also true, that if you have close friends that adopt healthy lifestyles and they begin to make healthy choices, then you tend to follow suit as well. They've discovered that lacking meaningful friendship makes you 2.5 times more likely to die prematurely as compared to those who have meaningful friendship in their life. Friends obviously do more than impact our life. They shape our lives. They are a powerful force that can impact outcomes in your life and mine. And it's a reminder that the power of friendship is influence. Influence is the ability to change things. Influence is the ability to shape outcomes. It literally means you flow into, and as you flow into things, you change the state of things. Friendship, it flows into your life, it flows into my life, or the absence of it flowing into your life and mine. It is a powerful thing. And friendship has the capacity to influence your life and my life on every level of our life, emotionally, psychologically, physically, spiritually. Our friends are quite likely the most powerful force of influence that exists in your life and mine. And we should just all stop and think about that for a moment. That our friends may just be, according to what science has discovered, the most powerful influence in your life and mine. They have the power to influence us to move forward, or they can use their influence to hold us back. They can, you know, influence our mindsets, our beliefs, our perspective. They can contribute to, you know, wide thinking or narrow thinking, deep thinking or shallow thinking. MRIs have even shown, and this is interesting, MRIs have actually shown that our brain waves are essentially a reflection of the brain waves of the people who are closest to us as far as our friends go. In other words, we sync up with the people that are closest to us. The friends that are closest to us, we sync up with them in significant ways. And that's the reason they have the influence to lift up or tear down. That's the reason they have the influence to move our mental health in a good direction or a not so good direction, or impact our physical health or our financial health. Or as you know, the old saying goes, your network is often a reflection of your net worth. Friends, we've been, you know, it's been said that we are the average of the 5 closest friends that we have in almost every measurable way. And this is the reason that We tell our middle school students and our high school students, and we also try to remind adults, just as we are today, that friends determine the quality and the direction of our life. Now, if you're a parent, you know the power of friendship, because as a mom or as a dad, you are dramatically interested. You are significantly interested in who your son or daughter becomes friends with, because you know the power of friendship can determine the quality and the direction of one's life. You know that the quality of one's future is often connected to the quality of their friends. But as we get older, we forget about this. We forget that even our friends as adults, that they point the way to our destiny. And destiny is just another word of, you know, another way of saying destination. It's where we end up. And it's our friends that are able to predict where we end up in life because of their influence. In other words, who we travel with in life determines where we end up in life. That's just a principle that we see not only in the scriptures, but we see validated in science in the 20th and 21st century. So what's the point? The point is this, that friends have the power to influence you and me in a greater degree than anything else perhaps in our life. They can make us better, stronger, wiser, happier, and healthier. And you say, why is it that way? Why is that the reality? Because God wired us for friendship. You remember in the book of Genesis when God created Adam, it was after he created everything else in the created order. And after everything that God created, he would say, this is good, this is good, this is good, this is good. He gets to Adam and he says, this is not so good. And it wasn't that something was wrong. It was something was missing. There was a relationship missing. There was a friendship missing, because you and I were created for relationship. We were created for friendship. We were created to exist in community. That's how we know that we are made in the image of God. God is Father, God is Son, God is Holy Spirit. They are three in one, but yet they exist in perfect community with one another. They work in relationship with one another, and it's this mystery that betrays our ability to communicate it. But part of God's image on your life and my life is that we were created to exist within relationships. And that fundamental need for relationship and for friendship, we require it. You require it in order to become the fullest, truest, greatest version of yourself, because God wired it to be that way. And so with that as the backdrop, this brings me to today's unsung hero. He's not an apostle. He's not a prophet, and he wasn't high profile in any public way. He didn't write any books that we know of. He didn't perform any miracles that we have record of. There's no record of him preaching a sermon or praying prayers or winning anybody to faith. There's really no record of this guy doing anything that you and I, if we grew up in church or around church, would usually associate with a person of great faith or a person of greatness or significance. His life was unknown to most people in his generation. Most people didn't know who this guy was. Nobody really heard of this guy. And he was forgotten to most people. Even if you've read through the scriptures, you probably don't remember this guy. You blinked your eyes, and the amount of space that his story takes up, it's already in the rearview mirror. But he would never be forgotten to the people who knew him best. And the guy that I'm going to talk about today, I would wager that many of you have never heard his name before. And if you have heard his name before, you're not real sure what his story is. But today's unsung hero that I want to talk about is Onesiphorus, or Onesiphorus. Onesiphorus, and you're like, who in the world? New Testament, Old Testament, New Testament guy. Onesiphorus, he's found in the New Testament, and there's only two verses that speak about this man, Onesiphorus, or Onesiphorus. He's mentioned only two times. And what's really, I think, significant, at least for me, when I read about Onesiphorus or Onesiphorus, I'll use both of those interchangeably. Some people say one, some people say the other. I just chose to say both. I'll just be wrong half the time rather than all the time. But Onesiphorus, he's only mentioned two times, but he's only remembered for one thing. He's mentioned two times, but he's only remembered for one thing. He's remembered for being a friend. Onesiphorus was a friend. That's how he made the book. That's how he got included. That's how we even know his name today. This would be his greatest legacy. This would be his greatest contribution. This would be his lasting influence. The only reason that we can talk about Onesiphorus today is because At some point in his life, he decided that he was going to be a friend. He was going to be a true friend. He was going to be a meaningful friend. And as we think about Onesiphorus for the next few minutes, I just want to point out that what's true of him is also true for all the unsung heroes that we've talked about in all the previous weeks. And the theme that I think that ties them all together is the idea that greatness doesn't always look the way that we think that it does. Greatness comes in all sorts of packages and demonstrations. It can look like a Barnabas. It can look like a thief who's dying on the cross, who takes one last step of faith with his last and final breaths. It can be Jethro, who talks to his son-in-law about the pace of his life and how it's getting in the way of the purpose of his life. Or it can look like an Onesiphorus, who is a guy who's ordinary. He's like you, he's like me. He's got a family, most likely. He's got a job, he's got obligations, but yet he decides that he's gonna be a friend. And he reminds us, along with all the other unsung heroes, that greatness is not always super spiritual, whatever that means. It's not overtly public all the time. It isn't always, you know, being a prayer warrior or a great student of the scripture, and there's nothing wrong with any of those things. But great faith doesn't always come in the packages that we would expect it to come in. Greatness is something that we can do that may be simple, but yet it's profound. It's something that can be ordinary, but yet in its own way, it's extraordinary. And that was Onesiphorus. He did something simple, but it was profound. He did something ordinary, and it was extraordinary. He was a friend. And what is more simple than being a friend? But what else could be more profound at times than being a friend? Being a friend, we've heard about being a friend our entire lives, and there's nothing more ordinary than being a friend and having friends, but sometimes there's nothing more extraordinary than being a friend or having a friend. Paul writes of Onesiphorus in 2 Timothy, and this is where we pick up those verses. Paul writes, "You know that everyone in the province of Asia has deserted me. They've abandoned me, including Phygellus and Hermogenes." Now, we have no idea who Phygellus and Hermogenes is. However, they have been immortalized as deserters, as people who had abandoned Paul. We don't know who they are because this is the only time that they're mentioned, but Paul's writing this to Timothy, who is pastoring back in Ephesus, and evidently Timothy knew these two folks. He knew Phygellus and Hermogenes, and Paul, as he's writing to Timothy in his final letter, he says, "Listen, everybody basically from back in Asia, they have deserted me, they have abandoned me. These two, they have walked away from Paul. They've walked away from their friendship with Paul. Once upon a time, they were friends with the Apostle Paul, or they seemed to be friends with the Apostle Paul, but they have now since walked away from Paul." And let's face it, it wasn't always easy to be a friend to Paul. It wasn't always safe to be Paul's friend. It was not always in one's best interest to be a friend to Paul. It was not always popular to be Paul's friend. So it's not easy to be Paul's friend. It's not safe to be Paul's friend. It's not convenient to be Paul's friend. And if you're a selfish person, it's just not in your own best interest to be Paul's friend. So they've walked away. And we know that from some of other of Paul's writings that other people have walked away. Demas and other countless people who have turned their back on Paul or have decided to be Paul's enemies. So Paul, he's had some friends walk away. He's abandoned. Now, don't forget, I'm going to set up a little context, tell you a little bit of a story so that hopefully this text can come alive a little bit for us. Because if we don't know the backstory, it's a bit benign. It lacks a little bit of energy. But when we remember where Paul is and where he's writing from, Paul is writing from prison. For the past 20 years since Paul got converted, and we talked a little bit about that in week one with Barnabas, after Paul was converted, he and Barnabas, and then later on, Paul and Timothy and Silas and Luke and others, they would travel around from city after city after city after city in the Mediterranean rim of the Roman Empire, and they would go from one place to the other, and they would start churches. They would tell the good news of how Jesus came, Jesus died, Jesus was buried, and Jesus was raised from the dead, and they would tell that story, and people would believe, and then they would start a church, and then they would put leadership in place, and then they would go to the next place, and they would just keep repeating. So for the past 20 or so years, Paul has spent his life starting churches all throughout the Roman Empire. Around the year 54 AD, Paul begins what we refer to as his third missionary journey. And as you would guess it, he had taken two before. So on this third missionary journey around AD 54, he comes to the city of Ephesus. And it's a fabulous story that you can read about in Acts 19, Acts 20. He comes to Ephesus, a major metropolitan city in the first century. There's a major, you know, one of the ancient wonders of the world, the Temple of Diana is there. And it's a driving force of the economy. And Paul comes to town and he begins to preach the gospel. And all of a sudden, all of these people, you know, they become followers of Jesus and they abandon their paganism. They abandon their idolatry. Well, part of the economy was based on paganism and it was based on that idolatry. So the economic system in that city got tilted upside down, and because of it, a mob rose up against Paul. But Paul's a pretty bold guy. He's a pretty aggressive guy. He's a man's man. He stays in Ephesus, though he's not the most popular man in Ephesus. He stays there for 2 years and a few months. And he helps get this church started. This is where he meets Onesiphorus. Onesiphorus is from Ephesus. So somewhere along the way, Paul and Onesiphorus become friends during Paul's stay in Ephesus. At the end of those 2 years and a few months, the Apostle Paul, he decides to leave Ephesus. He goes to Greece. He spends some time in Corinth. Then he leaves Corinth and he goes back through Macedonia, back through Troas, and he goes back to the place called Philippi. We've got a letter in the New Testament called Philippians. That was Paul's letter to that group, but he goes back to Philippi so that he can set sail to Jerusalem. Now, he wants to go to Jerusalem, and all of his closest friends say, Paul, this is not a good idea. We beg you, don't go to Jerusalem, don't go to Jerusalem. They're gonna kill you when you get to Jerusalem. But again, Paul, he's a bit stubborn, he's very focused, he's got one thing on his mind, go to Jerusalem. And so nobody can talk him out of it. So he gets on a ship, he goes to Jerusalem. When he gets to Jerusalem, well, let me back up. Before he gets on board to go to Jerusalem, there's this great passage in the book of Acts where he bids farewell to the Ephesian elders, to the leadership of the church in Ephesus. And again, we're not sure, but I would suspect that maybe Onesiphorus was there when Paul looked at those Ephesian elders that he had spent a couple of years with and he said, listen, we're not gonna see each other anymore. Paul knew in some way that he was nearing the end of his ministry, that there was something gonna happen either in Jerusalem or somewhere in between. He just knew he was never gonna see these people again. It was really emotional and they hugged each other and they prayed for each other. And I suspect that maybe Onesiphorus was there. And so after Paul says goodbye to these Ephesian elders, he gets on a boat and he goes to Jerusalem. When he goes to Jerusalem, there's some enemies of his from Asia that happen to be in Jerusalem at the same time, and they recognize Paul. And there's a mob that forms at the temple, and Paul's arrested, and Paul's gonna have a hearing with the Sanhedrin, and there's just gonna be all of this drama that takes place. And so much so, Paul finds out that some of the Jewish leaders have hired a team of assassins, to hunt Paul down and kill him. Now, this is a reason you should read the New Testament. It's a lot more interesting than you think it is. So there's this band of assassins that are out there in the wilderness, just kind of lurking in the dark, waiting for Paul. They want him dead. And so Paul hears about this conspiracy. They tell the Romans. The Romans know that it's not safe for Paul in Jerusalem, and they don't want this man, who is also a Roman citizen, to die on their watch. So they send him to a place called Caesarea Maritima. It's a place that Herod built right on the Mediterranean Sea. And there he's gonna spend the next 2 years imprisoned there. And it's a great portion of the book of Acts. He's gonna stand before Festus and Felix and Agrippa. And there's that great story of where he stands before Agrippa and he shares his own conversion story. And at the end of it, Agrippa looks at Paul and says, you almost persuaded me. You almost convinced me to believe in this Jesus that you believe in. And so Paul, he stands up, he pleads his case, he defends himself. But in the end, he ends up appealing to his citizenship and his right as a Roman citizen. He appeals his case to Caesar. And when he did that, everything was done. The hearings in Caesarea Maritima was over, and Paul was booked on a ship and he was on his way to go stand trial in Rome. On the way to Rome, there's a shipwreck. It's a great story, but eventually Paul makes it to Rome and he's gonna spend the next 2 years under house arrest in Rome. And while he's there under house arrest, he's writing letters to some of these churches that we have record of in the New Testament. He's writing these letters from Rome, 2 years under house arrest. And it's kind of just supervised custody. You know, people are allowed to come see him. They're allowed to have conversations. You know, it's just house arrest. And that's when the book of Acts ends, with Paul under house arrest. But it's not the end of Paul's story. Sometime after Paul is released from house arrest, we believe, because of some other documents that are not in the New Testament, we believe that the Apostle Paul traveled all the way to Spain. And I imagine continued the work that he had been doing for the 20 plus years before. But after leaving Spain, he ends up back in Rome. And this is about the mid-60s AD. And this is after Nero has set Rome on fire. And now he's blaming the Christians for it. And now begins to ensue one of the greatest persecutions of Jesus' followers in the history of the world. And so Paul, who's now back in Rome, gets swept up in this persecution of Christians by Nero. He's arrested, but this time he's not placed in house custody or house arrest. This time he's placed in the Roman prison system, a series of dungeons located all throughout the city of Rome. There's all kinds of ancient writing about what the dungeon prison system was like. It was dark, it was damp, it was referred to as putrid conditions. There was stale air because there was no good ventilation system. One writer called it a sleepless place. One writer called it hell on earth. It was appalling in its filth. When it would rain, oftentimes many of the prisoners, and we can imagine easily that this was true of the Apostle Paul as well, that when it would rain, the sewage system would begin to gather in the prison cells. And so oftentimes the Apostle Paul most likely was sitting in raw sewage from the city of Rome up to his knees, maybe even higher, until it dissipated. During the day, the heat was unbearable. At night, it was damp. It was cold. It was just suffering. It was suffering both on a physical level and a psychological level, both body and soul, suffering inside the Roman prisons. This is where Paul is. This is where Paul's writing from when he says, "Everybody has deserted me. I have no friends that are standing with me or standing up for me." In 1 Timothy, he actually says, "At my first defense, no one stood with me." When the judge looked out and said, "Does anybody want to stand with Paul? Does anybody want to stand up for Paul? Does anybody want to defend Paul?" Nobody. Because people were walking away from Paul. His friends were abandoning him. He said, "I stood alone. It was too dangerous for anybody, too risky for anybody to stand with Paul." And so now he's in this prison and he's having to face it alone. And it's one thing to be where Paul's at. It's one thing to suffer. It's one thing to be in a place of difficulty. It's one thing to be in a place where you're hurting, but it's quite a different thing when you feel like you're in that place and in that season alone. When you're facing the hell that's in front of you or around you, you feel like you're facing it alone. That's a whole different level of suffering. Because for the last 20 years, Paul's been surrounded by friends. He's always had an entourage around him. Barnabas, Timothy, Silas, Luke, Aristarchus, Tychicus, the list goes on and on. He was always surrounded by people. And now in prison, he says, "Everybody has deserted me." And we all gotta just feel the pain of that for a moment. That a man who has given his life to people feels as though people have left him, abandoned him, forsook him. And this is a difficult season for the Apostle Paul. He says, "Everybody has abandoned me, including Phygellus and Hermogenes." But as the tension of that loneliness is in the air, there was a moment in time as everybody else walked out of Paul's life, somebody walked into Paul's life. And Paul says, "May the Lord show mercy to the household of Onesiphorus, because he often refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chains." Now, the name Onesiphorus, it means beneficial, or it means profitable. To know this guy was to your benefit. To be friends with this guy was a profit to you. You were gonna be better off having Onesiphorus as a friend. And Paul says, when I think about Onesiphorus, as he's writing this letter in prison, he knows that he is approaching death. When he thinks about the people who have been most meaningful and significant in his life, He forever will forever make record of the name Onesiphorus and what Onesiphorus did for him. He says, when I was at my lowest, when I was in the darkest place, when I was in the hardest place, when it seemed like everybody else had abandoned me, Onesiphorus stepped into my life and he often refreshed me. Now, the word refresh here is a loaded word and it's ripe with meaning and it helps us understand what kind of person Onesiphorus was. It helps us understand what a friend looks like. When he says he often refreshed me, it means he often brought life to me. Paul says when things felt lifeless, when life was just dull, when it seemed like all of life had gotten sucked out of where I was and what I was going through, he would often bring life to me because whenever he would show up, he just raised the level of life. It means that he often revived me. It was like a revival would come to town. He would spend time with me. He would talk with me. He would visit with me. And he revived me when I was withering away, when I was barely hanging on by a thread, when I was discouraged, when I was anxious, when I was kind of feeling sorry for myself because everybody has abandoned me and walked away from me. He showed up and he revived me. Over and over again, he would revive me back to a place where I would feel good again, where I felt healthy again, where I felt whole again. And it's this picture of a cool glass of water on a hot day. Every time I saw Onesiphorus coming my way, it was like he had a cool drink of water for me, and I was parched in the middle of a desert. And after he would spend time with me, it was like I'd been drinking cool water for hours. He refreshed me. He cheered me up. He encouraged me. And it's deeper than that. It was like Paul was saying, being with him was like rest for my soul. When I was alone and I was wrestling with my thoughts and I was wrestling with my demons and I was wrestling with my past and I was wrestling with my circumstances, it was also exhausting. But when he would show up, it was like rest. It was like a breath of fresh air because he refreshed me. He energized me. Somehow he took his energy and his life and he placed it in me and I felt life again. I felt energized again. He strengthened me. He relaxed me. Somehow he deposited peace in my heart and in my soul. That's what Paul had to say about Onesiphorus. And when Onesiphorus showed up, Paul was in a dark place. He was in a dangerous place. He was in a difficult place. He was in a painful place. Everybody else had walked out and walked away. But that's when Onesiphorus walked in because that's what a friend does. He risks his own safety to be Paul's friend. He risks his own safety to be a benefit to Paul, to be a prophet to Paul. He risks his own freedom because he himself could have gotten arrested. Somebody could have said, are you a Jesus follower? And he too could have ended up in prison. He risked his own freedom to benefit Paul. He risked his own reputation to benefit Paul, his own comfort to benefit Paul. He wasn't embarrassed or ashamed, Paul says, to be a friend to me when I was incarcerated, when I was in prison. He says, on the contrary, when he was in Rome, he searched hard for me until he found me. Now, let me tell you what you and I would have done. If we had a friend like Paul who was in prison, we know it's a dangerous place, a dark place, a painful place. If we knew it, let me tell you what a lot of us would have been tempted to do. We would have been tempted to talk ourselves out of going to find where Paul was. We would have said things like this to ourselves. Well, I just don't know what to say. I'd go see him, but I just don't know what to say. Or, you know, I'd love to go see him, but some people may not want somebody there. It may be easier for him without anybody there. And we give ourselves all these excuses, but he didn't do that. He heard that Paul's in prison. And here's what Onesiphorus knew. The thing that Paul needed most was freedom. Paul needed to be set free. But more than that, Onesiphorus knew that Paul needed a friend. He couldn't do anything about the freedom part, but he could do something about the friend part, and he decided to be Paul's friend. So he leaves Ephesus. Now, that doesn't mean anything to us. That's modern day Turkey, and for a lot of us geographically challenged people, it still doesn't mean anything to us. But he leaves Ephesus in modern day Turkey, and he's gonna make what is a 1,000-mile journey from Ephesus to Rome, not to go on vacation, but to be a friend. He makes a 1,000-mile journey in the ancient world, which was not easy, not safe to do. He crossed land and sea. Matter of fact, he crossed 3 major bodies of water. It was dangerous, it was expensive, it was time consuming. And to Onesiphorus, none of that mattered as much as Paul, his friend, mattered to him. They had worked together in Ephesus. They had bonded together. They had become friends in Ephesus, and now Paul's in Rome, and Paul has got all these people walking away, and Onesiphorus back in Ephesus when it would have been easy just to go about his day and go about his life and pray for Paul, request prayer for Paul at church, put Paul on the prayer chain, text all of his friends, pray for Paul. It would have been easy to do any of that stuff, but no, he decided, I'm leaving Ephesus. I'm taking a 1,000-mile journey. And I'm gonna go see Paul. Onesiphorus approached friendship the only way that you and I can if we're gonna be true friends. He approached it with this idea that friendship is the place we go to give, not receive. There's an old saying that says, I went out looking for a friend and I could not find one, but I went out to be a friend and I found friends everywhere. As long as you and I concern ourselves with what we're getting more than what we're giving, we'll never be a friend like Onesiphorus, and we'll not be much of a friend at all. The reason that a lot of people, sadly, a lot of Christians, they can't maintain friendships for any significant period of time is because somewhere along the way, you or I get obsessed with what we are getting or not getting. And we stop caring so much about what we're giving as a friend. But if we approach friendship with a mindset of this is about what I can give, not about what I can receive or what I can get out of it, that's what positions you and I to be able to be a friend like Onesiphorus. What does he get out of this? I can't think of much of anything. He decided that he was gonna be a friend that was most concerned with giving rather than receiving. This is the epitome of putting someone else first. And it seems like that might be at the heart of what we call Christian faith. This is the epitome of going the second mile, which kind of reminds me of a sermon. Jesus preached. Not only 1 mile, but go the second mile or go 1,000 miles if that's what it requires to be a friend. This is the epitome of doing for others as you would have them do for you, which Jesus said in Matthew 7, that this is the fulfillment of all the law of God. This is loving your neighbor as yourself. This is loving others as God in Christ has loved you. This is what Paul would call in the letter to the Galatians. This is faith working itself out in love. This is what it looks like to follow Jesus. This is following the example of Jesus, the teaching of Jesus. This is what Jesus would call greatness when you decide to serve somebody else, not for what you can receive, but because of what you can give. This is, I think, what Jesus would say. This is what it looks like to lose something valuable so that you can gain something far better and of far greater value. This is generosity that changes lives. This is grace. This is mercy. This is love. This is being at the very epicenter of God's activity, God's plan, and God's purpose. This is Onesiphorus. And when he shows up to Paul, he refreshes him because he went there to give and not to receive. He revived Paul. He brought life to Paul. He brought peace to Paul. He strengthened Paul. He encouraged him. He was a breath of fresh air. He brought rest to Paul's soul. He calmed him down. He brought a sense of joy and peace and hope to Paul. Now, let me ask you something. When you're given joy, hope, and peace, and rest, and life, and energy, and strength, and encouragement, what does that sound like to you? It sounds a lot like what we say God does for us. Is it not? Oh, God revived me. God brought life to me. God breathed life into me. God encouraged me. God gave me strength. God gave me joy. God gave me peace. God gave me a sense of hope. Now, don't miss this. This may be worth your trip today. A simple act of friendship by Onesiphorus. What was a simple act of friendship by Onesiphorus was tantamount to a divine intervention in the life of Paul. What was an ordinary, simple act of friendship for Onesiphorus was experienced as an intervention by God himself in the life of Paul. And it's a great reminder that an act of friendship can be the means of divine intervention. When Onesiphorus decided to be a friend, I don't know if he could have fully known that God was going to use his act of friendship as a means to a divine intervention. That when you and I decide to be friends to those who need friends, to be a true friend, a meaningful friend, sometimes we can be the means to a divine intervention. He was a friend, but Paul experienced it as the intervention of God. To be a friend, it may be the thing that God uses to intervene in somebody's life, to answer prayers in somebody's life. Your encouragement, your presence, the life you bring, the joy you bring, the peace you bring, it may be the answer to that person's prayer for what they've been praying for, and the way that God ships it into the life of that person. It may come through you. It may come through me. When we decide to show up when no one else will and no one else can, we just might find ourselves in the very epicenter of God's intervention and activity in the life of that person. Your words of encouragement, raising the level of life, instilling a sense of purpose and joy and hope, and all of those things that Onesiphorus did for Paul, that person may experience it as, God has done something profound in my life. Sitting with someone and you don't even know what to say, but you just sit. You go in the hospital room and you just sit there. A few weeks ago, a great friend of mine was in ICU and he couldn't talk and there was nobody else there at the moment. So I went and matter of fact, on one particular day, I took Jonathan, Jack, and Zach with me and we just kind of went there and, you know, we didn't have a lot to talk about. Wasn't, you know, a situation where there was a lot of, you know, it wasn't conducive for conversation. I mean, it was a serious grave situation as far as his health went. And sometimes you just go sit. Sometimes you just decide to be present. You share good news with somebody, a good report. You help them think about the possibilities and not the limitations. You help point out the good rather than the bad. You affirm them, you celebrate them. You remind them of their purpose. You remind them of their worth. You remind them of their contribution. And for them, they may experience that as a divine intervention. That's how Paul experienced it. And so he says, may the Lord grant that he will find mercy from the Lord on that day. You know very well in how many ways he helped me in Ephesus. There's lots of discussion about this verse, and I don't have time to go into it, but here's what I think Paul is saying. Onesiphorus has shown me mercy, love, kindness, and grace, and I hope he reaps what he has so generously sown in this life and the life to come. He helped me. He was a friend to me. And for Onesiphorus, this was his legacy. This was his greatest contribution to the kingdom of God. This was his lasting influence. He decided that he was going to be a friend that benefited his friends. He was going to be a friend that profited his friends. And I think Onesiphorus would say to all of us, so should you, so should I. We could all stand to be better friends. We could all stand to be better friends. So what do we learn? Let me give you just a few things before we wrap it up. A few things. Just take this with you. Good friends raise the level of life. You know what you gotta have to raise the level of life? Some life of your own. Some of you, you're just too miserable. Dull. Sad saps. Baptized in pickle juice once upon a time. Cheer the flip up, would you? How are you gonna raise the level of life if you too are lifeless? If you don't have abundant life, overflowing, flowing over into the life of people, you can't do this. How are you gonna encourage people if you're not encouraged? How are you gonna refresh if you're not fresh? Give life. Lord, don't take it. Some of you should never visit anybody in the hospital. Should never visit anybody in the hospital. You look terrible. Use our words. The proverb says, the words of the reckless pierce like swords, but the tongue of the wise bring healing. Now, what Ani Sifras did for Paul, he brought healing. Gracious words are like honeycomb, sweet to the soul, healing to the bones. Even Paul wrote about this in Ephesians 4. He says, don't let any corrupt words proceed out of your mouth. Don't puke on people with your negativity. You ever been rocking a baby, newborn, and they puke on your shoulder? It doesn't matter how many times you scrub that stuff. It stinks. You carry that stank all day. Some of you, that's how you treat people with your words. They carry your stank all day long. You just puke on people. Just negative, pessimistic, small thinking, limited thinking, little faith, little hope, little joy, little peace. He says, speak to build up, speak to give life, impart grace. Good friends, we learn from Ani Sifras, make us better, wiser, stronger, healthier. We become the better version of ourselves. Here's what friends do. Friends lend their strength to their friend's weakness. Let me show you what I mean. Some of us, our weakness is pessimism. We need a good, optimistic friend who can lend us that strength to help us grow in that area. Some of us, we're too serious. We take life too serious. We take ourselves too serious. We take everything too serious. And we need a friend who's got the strength to help us lighten up a little and have a little fun. Some of us are too undisciplined. And we need a good disciplined friend who can lend us that strength. Some of us are too cautious and we're afraid to take risks. We need those friends that are bold enough to risk. Some of us are too legalistic. We need some friends that are gracious in our lives. Some of us, we've got these areas of weakness and we need strength, and we get that strength from friends. That's why they says, the proverb says, walk with the wise, become wise. Iron sharpens iron. So one person sharpens another. Proximity matters. And that brings us to good friends. Freely give grace, because proximity brings friction. And if you've never had to forgive a friend, you don't have friends. And if a friend has never had to forgive you, you don't have friends. You have acquaintances. You have people you date, and you still put your best foot forward. And you're not real. And you don't let them get to know you. Because if they get to know you, they're gonna know that you're jacked up and screwed up and messed up, just like everybody else. And when you got jacked up, screwed up, messed up people in friendship with each other, guess what? It's messy. And you gotta freely give grace. Hatred stirs up conflict, but love covers all wrongs. A person's wisdom yields patience, and it's to one's glory to overlook an offense. Godly friends, good friends, also lovingly speak truth. Because the wounds from a friend can be trusted, but the enemy multiplies kisses. Friends don't use the truth as weapons. They don't use the truth to hurt. They use the truth to help. And the wound is like a surgeon's wound that was necessary, and it was done correctly, and it was done cautiously, and it was done skillfully to bring about healing, not hurt. Good friends make life easier. The good times better, the hard times easier. That's what Ani Sifras did for Paul. And they make life a little easier because we don't have to do life alone. We have somebody walking with us, somebody standing with us, for us, in our corner, in our foxhole. That was Ani Sifras. So what do we learn from this guy who decided to be a friend and we know nothing else about him? Here's what I think we learn. Pursue, build, and maintain healthy friendships with people who make you better, take you further, lift you higher, lead you deeper. And this may not always look the way you think it looks. And this may not always mean what you think it means. And if you do this, and if I do this, our future self will thank us for it. They will thank us for it. Because our friends help show us our future. And if we will decide to be an Onesiphorus, maybe one day somebody will tell their story. And one of the most profound moments of their life will be what was something simple and ordinary for you. But they'll talk about how perhaps through your friendship, it was like a divine intervention that God did something in their life because you decided and I decided to do something as simple and ordinary as being a friend. Heavenly Father, Lord, these unsung heroes, they give us such practical examples of what great faith and following Jesus can look like. We're not all great in understanding the scriptures. We're not all able to sing, and we're not all able to stand in front of people, and we're not all able to work with kids, and we're not all able to do all the things that other people do. But God, we can encourage. We can take small steps of faith. God, we can be Onesiphorus. We can choose to be a friend that refreshes, to be a friend that benefits and profits those around us. So God, help us to think about how we can be a better friend, how we can approach friendship with the mentality of giving and not receiving. Show us how to make a difference in other people's lives just through simple friendship. I want us to bow our heads for just a moment and keep our eyes closed. And I just want you to just, in your own words, for just a moment, ask God to help show you where and who and how you can be a better friend. Who you can refresh. Who you can lend your strength to that may not be strong in the area that you're strong in. Father, for the next moment, just speak into our hearts.